Okay, so let's dive into a case that's going to make you rethink everything you thought you knew about secured transactions, especially if you're like knee-deep in UCC Article 9 right now.
Oh yeah, this one's a classic. Like, seriously, if you can wrap your head around this case, you're golden.
We're talking about Nelson v. John Deere Credit, also known as In Re Troop. Buckle up because this one's a wild ride.
No kidding. Like, it's all about this seemingly straightforward question. When is a tractor considered consumer goods? Sounds simple, right?
Yeah, you'd think so. But the implications of that classification for perfecting a security interest are huge.
Absolutely massive.
And the story behind this case, I mean, the facts are just crazy. We've got the troops, they buy this tractor, tell the dealer it's strictly for personal use on their property, you know, just typical homeowner stuff. Then they turn around and use it for, get this, farming. And to top it off, they're claiming business tax deductions for it. You'd think John Deere Credit, the lender, would be in a tough spot, right?
Yeah, for sure. Seems like a slam dunk case for the trustee.
But hold on, the court actually sided with John Deere Credit. You heard that right. Meaning the troop's whole argument about an unperfected security interest totally fell apart.
I know, right? It's like, wait, they said one thing and did another, and the creditor still wins. How is that even possible?
Exactly. So that's what we're going to unpack today. We're going deep, deep, deep into this ruling, figuring out the court's logic, and pulling out the big lessons Nelson v. John Deere Credit teaches us, especially for anyone dealing with secure transactions.
Yeah, because this case, it just highlights some really crucial principles in a way that's like impossible to ignore.
All right, so to get us started, let's lay out the facts. Back in July 2001, we have Robert and Dawn Troop. They decide to buy a shiny new John Deere tractor costing like $16,539. And naturally, they finance it through
John
credit.
Deere Credit.
Of course. Now, at this time, they're living on a 10-acre property in Colorado.
And when they're chatting with the dealer, you know, making the deal, they specifically say they'll be using this tractor for, you know, regular homeowner things like maintaining irrigation ditches, hauling dirt, hay, maybe some snow removal in the winter, basic stuff, right?
Totally. But here's where the paperwork comes in, and this is where things get really interesting.
Oh, yeah, this is key.
So, on their credit application, they've got to list their occupations, right? Robert's in management, pulling in a decent $4,500 a month.
Not bad.
And Dawn, she's working as an auto body estimator, making around $36,000 a year. Importantly, they both have demanding jobs, working long hours.
So not exactly your typical full-time farmer lifestyle, right?
Exactly. Now, the real kicker, the security agreement. It has these boxes clearly marked personal and commercial.
Pretty straightforward.
You'd think. So, which box do they check?
Let me guess. Personal.
Bingo! And not only that, the agreement flat out states, like word for word, that this is a consumer credit transaction and the tractor is going to be used primarily for, you know, personal, family, or household purposes. Seems pretty clear cut, right?
Yeah, on paper, totally.
But the story doesn't end there. The troops, they get their tractor, start using it, and here's the twist, they start farming with it.
Oh boy, here we go.
And guess what? When tax time rolls around, they're claiming 100% full-on business use for that tractor, taking those sweet, sweet depreciation deductions like it's nobody's business.
Wow. So their story's changing a bit now, isn't it?
Fast forward to September 2004, they file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. A bankruptcy trustee starts poking around and sees this whole tractor situation.
Yeah, trustee's gonna notice that, especially with those tax filings.
And the trustee's like, hold on a minute, something doesn't add up here. They start arguing that John Deere's security interest wasn't perfected because, well, you know, that tractor was clearly being used for business.
Makes sense.
But here's the crazy part. In court, the troops change their tune again. Now they're saying, oh no, actually, 90% of the tractor use was for personal reasons.
90%. That's a pretty big jump from what those tax forms said.
It is. But despite all this back and forth, the commercial use, the tax deductions, you know, the whole nine yards, the bankruptcy court actually ruled in favor of John Deere Credit.
Whoa, hold on. So even with all that, the lender still won.
Yep. And this takes us straight to the heart of the legal issue we're diving into.
Right to the core of it.
Was that John Deere tractor considered consumer goods under UCC Section 9102.23? Because, you see, that classification is what determines if John Deere's purchase money security interest, that PMSI, was automatically perfected when they attached it.
Right, because if it's consumer goods, they're good to go. Automatic perfection. But if it's not, if it's commercial, then, well, they probably needed to file a financing statement, which they didn't do.
Exactly. So let's break this down. What exactly are we talking about when we say consumer goods under the UCC?
Okay, so UCC Section 9-102-23, it defines consumer goods as goods that are used or bought for use primarily for personal, family, or household purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that word, primarily, that's super important.
Okay, I'm seeing where this is going. So it all hinges on the debtor's intended use, right?
Absolutely. And that brings us to, like, the golden rule, the principle that decided this whole case.
Yeah.
The court was crystal clear. When we're figuring out if something's a consumer good or not, what matters is the debtor's intended primary use at the time the security interest is created, not later, not after they change their mind or how they use it. That moment of creation, that's the snapshot we're looking at.
So just to make sure I've got this right, let's say I buy a super fancy laptop thinking, oh, this is just for, you know, Netflix and chilling, but then I get bitten by the entrepreneurial bug, start a graphic design business, and bam, that laptop is now my workhorse, used commercially all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Even with that change, what controls is still that initial Netflix and chill intent.
Exactly. That initial intent at the time of the security agreement is what matters for perfection. The court really drilled down on that point. They said, look, subsequent use, even if it changes completely, it's irrelevant to whether that security interest was perfected or not.
Wow. So it's like a time capsule. That initial intent is frozen.
Exactly. And it makes sense, right? Imagine lenders having to track every single item they finance, like 24/7, making sure it's being used exactly as the debtor initially said.
That would be chaos.
Total chaos. And expensive and time-consuming, just a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, no lender wants to be a private investigator on top of everything else.
Exactly. And this leads us to the second big point the court hammered. The debtor's representation. Remember that security agreement with the personal box check, the whole this is for personal, family, or household purposes bit?
Mm-hmm.
The court basically said John Deere had every right to rely on what the troops told them in writing at the beginning.
So it's like trust but verify, but more like trust what's in writing.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
They weren't obligated to go on a stakeout spying on how the troops were using that tractor.
Interesting. So the creditor doesn't have to be a detective.
Nope. And this is where it gets even juicier. Because remember, we have conflicting stories, right? The tax returns screaming 100% business use. Then the court testimony with that 90% personal use claim.
Right. They're all over the place.
And the court, they carefully considered all this back and forth. But ultimately, they said, look, what matters most is that initial representation, the clear statement the troops made to John Deere in the security agreement. That trumped everything else.
So the court was basically saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. You can't claim one thing to the IRS, then try to pull a 180 in bankruptcy court.
It seems like the court's saying you can't game the system like that.
Exactly. And there's another layer to their reasoning, some big picture stuff that's really important. They explicitly said their decision was about protecting creditors who are acting in good faith, who rely on what debtors tell them. Imagine if it was the other way around.
Lenders would be terrified to, like, loan anyone anything.
Totally. It would just create a huge mess for secured transactions. Think about it. Every time someone wanted to finance something, the lender would have to do this insane amount of due diligence, constantly monitoring, checking in.
Yeah, the costs would be through the roof.
Absolutely. And to back up their decision, the court cited some well-established precedent, basically saying, look, this isn't some revolutionary new idea.
Mm.
It's a well-established principle that when a debtor clearly states how they'll use the collateral, and it's in writing, the creditor can rely on that, even if things change later on. It's about keeping things predictable, you know, making sure the system works. Like one of the sources points out, just about every case dealing with this issue holds that the dealer can rely on the debtor's written consumer representation.
Okay, that makes sense. But, I mean, isn't there a possibility for this to be unfair? Like, what if a debtor really does have a change in circumstances, something they couldn't have predicted?
That's a really good point. And the court actually addressed this head on. They said, look, we get it, but creditors can't be expected to be mind readers. They can't predict the future or be constantly checking in. It's just not practical.
Hmm.
And more importantly, they emphasized that the debtor signed that agreement knowing the terms.
Right. So they're bound by what they agreed to.
Exactly. Unless, of course, there's some shady stuff going on, like the creditor tricked them or something. But in this case, the trustee couldn't prove that John Deere knew about the troops' commercial use from the get-go. So the court was like, look, they signed it. They're bound by it.
All right. So if our law student listeners are only going to remember a few things from this case, what should they be?
Three big things. Number one, classify that collateral the second that security agreement is signed. That's the defining moment. Number two, what matters most for classifying is the debtor's stated intent, what they say they'll use it for, and it's going to be clearly documented in that agreement. And number three, creditors, most of the time, they can take those representations at face value. They don't need to hire a PI to follow the debtor around.
Right. And just to reiterate, like driving it home,
yeah,
whatever happens after that security interest is attached, like if the debtor suddenly starts using the collateral in a totally different way, it doesn't change the perfection of that security interest, that initial classification. That's what sticks.
100%. Like imagine if the troops had checked that commercial box instead.
Yeah.
John Deere would have had to file a financing statement to perfect their interest, no question about it.
Wow. So something as simple as checking the wrong box can have huge consequences.
Huge.
For anyone prepping for the bar exam, what's the key takeaway here?
Laser focus on what the debtor said they'd use the collateral for when they signed that security agreement. That's the holy grail. Don't get lost in the weeds of what they actually did later. Initial intent, initial intent, initial intent.
Got it. Now, are there any like sneaky little details or nuances people might miss about this whole classification thing?
Oh yeah, definitely. First off, how the debtor treats the asset for taxes. Like if they're taking those business deductions, it doesn't override the UCC's definition of what a consumer good is.
Oh, so the IRS and the UCC, they're playing by different rules.
Totally different ballgame.
Yeah.
And remember the trustee in this case, they had to prove John Deere knew about the commercial use right from the start. They couldn't, so the court sided with the lender based on that signed agreement.
Right. And the whole thing about claiming personal use for the loan, then turning around and claiming business use for tax purposes, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, a bold move, but it didn't work out for them. Nope. All right, let's hammer these concepts home with some key quotes straight from the sources. So the UCC itself defines consumer goods as goods that are used or bought for use primarily for personal, family, or household purposes.
And the courts keep repeating this. The classification doesn't change because of later use. It's all about that initial moment.
Simple and straightforward, right?
Absolutely. And to echo what the courts have consistently said, just about every case that has dealt with this issue holds that the dealer can rely on the debtor's written consumer representation.
It's like a mantra, debtor's written representation.
And then there's this powerful statement. A debtor who makes representations in a security agreement regarding the intended use of the collateral should be bound by those representations. No wiggle room there.
And finally, this quote sums up the whole case perfectly. The classification of the collateral for purposes of perfection of the security interest is determined when the security interest attaches. The later use of the collateral for another purpose than as stated in the security agreement is irrelevant in determining whether the security interest is perfected. Boom.
Mic drop moment right there. So wrapping this all up, what's the big takeaway from Nelson v. John Deere Credit?
Well, the biggie is that it establishes, without a doubt, that what the debtor says they'll use the collateral for at the very moment they sign that security agreement, that's what determines how it's classified under the UCC. And once that classification is set, it doesn't matter if they change their mind later. The creditor's golden. That initial representation, it's everything. This clarity is essential for everyone involved, lenders, debtors, everyone. It makes the whole system more predictable.
So final thought for all you aspiring lawyers out there.
Don't underestimate the power of the details in those security agreements, especially those seemingly simple statements about how the collateral is going to be used. Nelson v. John Deere Credit shows that those details can have some serious legal bite, especially when it comes to perfection and bankruptcy. Both sides, debtors and creditors, need to understand exactly what those initial classifications mean because the consequences can be huge.
Absolutely. It's like checking a box can change your whole legal world. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Nelson v. John Deere Credit. We hope it's helped clear up some of the trickier aspects of secured transactions.
Yeah, and maybe it's even sparked some new questions, like given how important those initial representations are, should creditors have to do more to check them out? Are there ways to protect debtors if something unexpected happens and they have to change how they're using the collateral?
Great questions. Lots to think about.
Definitely.
Until next time.
See ya.